Good evening and welcome to the 45th Legislative District Live Telephone Town Hall with Representatives Larry Springer and Roger Goodman. My name is Andy. I'm going to be moderating tonight's call. We are calling you live tonight to give you an opportunity to chat with your representative and ask them any questions you might have, like on the state budget, education, jobs, transportation, or public safety, or anything that might be on your mind tonight. If you have a question for Representative Springer or Representative Goodman, all you have to do is press *3 on your phone right now, and we'll connect you with a volunteer who will place you in our question queue. Again, that's pressing *3 right now is all you have to do to ask your elected official a question on tonight's call. Again, this is a live telephone town hall. We're calling you because you live you're a registered voter in the 45th Legislative District, and your two representatives, Representative Goodman and Springer, want to hear from you on the issues you care about the most. So please go ahead and press *3 right now if you have any questions you'd like to ask them tonight. Now I'll turn it over to the representatives for some opening remarks.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us. This is Representative Larry Springer. This is probably the seventh or eighth one of these we've done over the years, and we really appreciate all of you out there taking the time to join us because it's really important to us to hear from you. This is shaping up to be a very challenging legislative session. We have an awful lot of work to do in terms of writing a new two-year budget, especially given the recent Supreme Court decision that mandates significant additional revenue being sent to our elementary or our K through 12 education system. Plus, we have a real obligation, I think, to restore funding in higher ed, and we certainly are eager to try and pass a transportation package as well, which we've been trying to do for the last couple of years. So with that, Roger, if you want to enter in.
Thanks, Larry. This is Representative Roger Goodman, and I'm also very pleased to participate tonight. I really like to hear your questions and engage with you. So as Larry said, it's a challenging session in terms of funding our education system and getting a transportation revenue package passed. But also remember that our mental health system is underfunded, and there's another Supreme Court decision mandating that we spend quite a bit to bolster our mental health system, which really needs a lot of work. We don't rank very well nationally in terms of what we invest in our mental health system. So I'm the chair of the Public Safety Committee, and I'm working hard on, particularly this year, on protecting vulnerable adults from certain types of financial crimes and exploitation, and also continuing work on reducing domestic violence and drunk driving. So, but we'd be very interested in to hear your questions tonight, so let's kick it off.
All right. Again, folks, that is *3. If you want to ask a question tonight for your representatives, that's *3. Go ahead and press that now. We'll go ahead and get you in the queue to speak with your representatives. We still got some questions coming in, so let's go ahead and just kick it off with the two of you and let us know what your top priorities are going to be this session.
Again, this is Representative Springer. One of the things I forgot to mention, and we probably should, Roger did, the committees that I serve on, I serve my the caucus as the deputy majority leader. So I'm a member of the eight-member leadership team for our caucus, and I've been appointed to the Appropriations Committee. That's the committee that makes the decision on how to spend our revenue. I'm also on the Finance Committee, which is the committee that determines how we raise the revenue, and I also serve on the K-12 Education Committee. So, and I also come from a long history with local government. I'm former mayor of Kirkland and served on the council there for several years, so I have a real interest in our local government finance. So I'm sponsoring a couple of bills. One is a infrastructure financing bill that will help cities and counties pay for the infrastructure necessary to go into redevelopment in places like, for example, the Totem Lake Mall, which is certainly in desperate need of redevelopment. I also have a bill that will allow cities to use the revenue they derive from real estate excise taxes without raising the taxes, just using the existing revenue in more flexible ways. So trying to make it a little easier on our local governments.
And I, as I said before, I'm working hard on criminal justice issues as the chair of that committee. The vulnerable adult bill that just got a hearing yesterday really aims at those who establish a trusting relationship with an older adult and then abuse that by stealing from them or even withholding the means of life. So we want to hold those people accountable. In the higher ed area, I have a proposal that I'm about to introduce, which I think is going to be pretty popular, that we call it the tuition lock. So if your student graduates in on time completion, then you pay in your senior year what you paid in your freshman year. And so it provides predictability and affordability for parents and students to know what they're going to pay in, for their higher education, as long as they complete on time, and we want to encourage that. So I'm hoping that proposal moves quickly.
One thing I guess I would add, probably should have added at the beginning of our conversation, is the state of the Washington's budget and revenue climate. Right now, as we begin the writing of the next two-year budget, we have an obligation, as I mentioned earlier, to fully fund K-12 education. Most of us down here believe that really requires another $1.5 billion of additional spending in K-12 over and above what we're currently spending. We also, as Roger mentioned, have an obligation for mental health funding and a couple of other lawsuits that we have lost, and that's going to cost us at least another $100 million. The higher ed system, which we have devastated. So we've got an awful lot of funding requirements there. The good news is we are experiencing probably about a $3 billion increase in revenue this biennium over last, which sounds great, and it is great, but just to keep it in perspective, that brings us to a revenue level that's about where it was when the recession started. So with that, I think we might be ready for a question. We'll see here in a minute.
We are ready, yes. And for those who are just now joining the call, this is a live telephone town hall with your representatives, Representative Roger Goodman and Larry Springer. If you have a question for your representatives, press *3 right now, *3, and we'll get you in the line. We've got a lot of great questions coming in. First, we're going to go to John, continuing on the higher ed theme. John has a question about the GET program. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Mike, and the question is, with the current state of state finances, do you foresee any failures or alterations in the GET program?
No, we're making a promise, and we have to live up to that, kind of like a pension, right? And so if there are amounts, and Larry can add, he actually was serving on the higher ed committee before, so he might know a little bit more about this, but I'm just speaking in terms of our obligation. If whatever parents expect is going to be the value, we have to live up to it if the cost of college goes up. So we're going to make good on that promise.
The one thing that could happen in the GET program would be to change the formula going forward for new enrollees so that the return on investment might be a little different if you join now. But if you have made a contract with the state, as Roger said, we will honor that, and that will be part of our future budget obligations.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you. And if you got a question tonight, go ahead and press *3 on your phone right now. We'll get you in the queue. Next, we are going to go out to Ralph, who's got a question about DUI penalties. Go ahead, Ralph. You are live with your representatives.
Oh, my goodness.
Ralph, are you there?
We are here. Ralph, are you here?
Okay, but I didn't make it.
Ralph, are you on the line?
All
right, we'll see if we can come back to Ralph here a little bit later. Next, we are going to go to Kathy, who has a question about our mental health system. Go ahead, Kathy. You are live with your representatives.
Thank you. My question on mental health is, how does Washington State rank in comparison to the other states in terms of our mental health systems?
Well, it's bad news. We rank 48th in the country in what we invest in our mental health system. So we have a lot of improvements. And as I said, there are actually three court cases, one of which hasn't been decided yet, but we're going to lose, arguing that civil rights have been violated and proper health care hasn't been provided. The infrastructure isn't in place for treatment and evaluation. It goes back to the 1960s when we passed the Community Mental Health Act on the federal level. But that promise was never really met. We don't have those community mental health facilities, and we now have been ordered by the court to pay for that, and that's at least $100 million. So I'm encouraged. We're going to be creating that place to go if you are in crisis, and we don't have that right now.
All right, thank you. If you got a again, if you got a question for your representatives, *3, we'll get you in our question queue. Next, we're going to go out to Marjorie, who's got a question about homelessness. Go ahead, Marjorie. You're live with Representatives Goodman and Springer.
All right. Last night, I saw a story in the Seattle Times about how difficult certain cities over here on the east side are making it for churches to host tent cities for the homeless. I am concerned because the city of Kirkland is bearing the city and the churches in the city are bearing the brunt of the weight of serving this community who need help. They need a safe place to live. They deserve it. They're human beings. And Bellevue and Redmond and Woodinville and Bothell cannot just keep turning their eyes and making things so difficult for churches who want to help these people retain their humanity. And I'm wondering if there's anything that you can do to help with this.
Thanks, Marjorie. This is Representative Springer. Thanks for those comments. I couldn't agree with you more. As the former mayor of Kirkland, we struggled mightily many years ago when the tent cities first arrived. There was a lot of community angst about it. Many of the neighbors were very frightened by the possibility of homeless people living close to them. I can tell you, and I hope people in Redmond, Woodinville, and maybe even Bellevue might be listening, the incidence of anything untoward happening in the last 10 years of homeless encampments in Kirkland has been just virtually zero. There have been no issues. These are very safe places. And an interesting tidbit that I didn't realize is that well over 50% of the residents of a tent city are actually working every day. Now, they're not working at very good jobs, and they're not making enough money to pay the exorbitant rents that are now coming about because of the housing bubble, but they are working. And about 50 to 60% of those people in tent cities are only there for a short period of time. I agree with you. I'm not sure what the state can do. It's a little unclear. We did try some legislation a few years ago to mandate tent cities. It didn't work very well, and I'm not real favorable toward state mandates to locals, but hopefully they will get the message.
Thanks, Marjorie. I just want to make a brief comment. I have received some messages of concern, particularly from Woodinville, about syringes in the gutter and other things happening. And I know that at the tent cities there's very strict rules about who can be admitted and the behavior there. So it could be that the tent cities might be attracting others who are not admitted, and they might be hanging around. And perhaps that's a nuisance issue or public safety issue. But in general, yeah, we really want to support these. And it's just a shame that we have to have them at all. It's amazing that we don't have the honor their dignity and provide housing for everyone.
All right. Thank you, Marjorie. Excellent question. Again, if you have a question for Representative Goodman or Springer tonight, *3 on your telephone, and we'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Scott, who's got a question about taxes. Go ahead, Scott. You are live with Representative Goodman and Springer.
Hi, thank you. I think everybody would agree that our state has a pretty regressive tax system, and we know that there's been attempts to have a state income tax that have, failed. My question is anybody got a gumption to put this together, promoting a sales tax or an income tax with either the elimination or a great reduction in the sales tax?
Scott, this is Representative Springer. A couple of points I'd want to make there. One, you are absolutely right. Washington State ranks virtually dead last in the nation for our regressive tax system. We have the most regressive tax system in the country, and that's primarily because of two things. One, the sales tax, which is disproportionately hits low-income people, and the other is the gross receipts B&O tax that taxes a business on their sales, not their profit. Both of those very regressive taxes. So that's why we're in the position that we are in. the income tax issue, as you may have remembered, has been on the ballot probably at least two to three times over the last 30 years. The voters have soundly rejected it every time. I would agree with you, the only way this makes any sense going forward to try again would be if we really spent time revamping our entire tax system as a whole, not just picking one piece of it like the income tax or the B&O tax or the sales tax or the property tax. We need a comprehensive package for all of it, which would include probably some constitutional caps on, for example, property tax or perhaps sales tax, so that the voters believe that those taxes won't be raised again anyway. So I agree with you. That's the approach we need to take. It's probably not going to happen this session, but it's one that I think a lot of us are beginning to think is the only solution here.
Yeah, this is Representative Goodman. I agree. You can't just talk about one tax here or taxing this particular group. It really requires a comprehensive look at our revenue system, which is unfair and unstable. And so Larry jokes about putting brilliant people in a room with green eye shades and not letting them out until they solve it. But frankly, even here in the legislature back in 2005, 2006, the Finance Committee in the House did come up with a comprehensive bipartisan proposal to revamp our tax system, and it didn't really get to the light of day. So it really is the political challenge of bringing together all the parties to agree rather than solving. We could solve it by crunching the numbers, but we have to get everybody to buy in, and that requires leadership. And frankly, we haven't had that leadership.
All right, excellent question. Again, if you got a question tonight for Representatives Goodman or Springer, *3 on your phone right now. We'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Janice in Redmond, who's got a question about the criminal justice system. Go ahead, Janice. You're on live with your representatives.
Yes, the way I understand it, with some of the less of crimes that is committed and they are releasing them back into society to do whatever they did again, I can't see why they can't put them in some kind of a work group to keep them out of trouble. And also, I understand there's people that comes from out of state because they've got the wind that it's okay to come out here and commit a crime because they'll let you go anyway.
Well, Janice, thank you very much for that question. This is complicated, actually, because there's all sorts of different types of crime and different types of people and circumstances, but you're right. The word spread that you could come to Western Washington, stick your finger in the pocket of your coat, and do what's called a note robbery. Go to the bank, pretend like you have a gun, and hand a note to the teller, and there were a rash of bank robberies. All the bank robbers were coming here to do that, and then we changed the law. We made it so that becomes first-degree robbery, which is a huge penalty, and all of a sudden the bank robbers went elsewhere. Similarly, with auto theft, the word spread that, particularly on the West Coast, you could come up here and steal 6 cars before you got in trouble. And we toughened the law there as well, and so we've seen a reduction in auto theft as well. I want to comment on property crimes. This year in my committee, in the House Public Safety Committee, we're going to hear an innovative bill to hold property offenders accountable. We have the highest rate of property crimes in the country. We also have the highest incarceration period for property offenders. So in other words, we're locking them up for a long period of time. But we're also the only state that doesn't supervise property offenders after they get out. So you see what's happening. So what we're going to do is shift resources to make sure we're watching them in the community. And many people who steal or forge checks or whatever, they have a drug habit. And so they need treatment. They need some sort of therapeutic program to help them get back on track. And so we're going to be investing in that because that's what the evidence shows works. But it is complicated. We're going to keep working on it.
And this is Representative Springer, and I'm just going to say ditto to what Representative Goodman said. He's the expert in terms of public safety, so we can move on.
Excellent. Great question. Again, if you have a question, *3 on your phone right now, and we'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Stephen, who's got a question about college. Go ahead, Stephen. You're live with your representatives. Stephen, are you there?
Going to pay for college? Yes.
Go ahead, Stephen.
Are you going to make the colleges less expensive?
Well, good question.
Stephen, this is Representative Springer. It sounded like your question was, are we going to make college less expensive? We are going to try. No promises at this point because it's too early in the session to really know how much money we're going to be able to steer toward our higher education system. But we recognize that college has become so expensive, and that's primarily due to the recession that occurred 5-6 years ago. Before that recession, the state paid about 70% of the cost of a college degree. Now we pay about 30%, and the student pays 70%. And we know that that formula, that split has to change, has to reverse itself. The way we do that is the state legislature appropriates additional money to send to our colleges. We hope to be able to do that this year. How much, I can't really tell you yet because it's too early. But our sincere hope is that we will keep tuition increases, which is what's driving the cost for your education, keeping tuition costs to either zero or maybe small single-digit increases, not the double-digit increases we've seen over the last few years.
Yes, Stephen, I'm not sure if we can promise you that we'll make college less expensive, but I sure hope we won't make college more expensive. So we're going to try to hold the line this year. And I'm going to repeat about the proposal that I've made to hold tuition steady if you complete on time. So you wouldn't pay any more in any of the freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year. You pay the same amount, and that would provide more affordability for college.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. I think you get the award for the youngest caller of the night at 10 years old, so we appreciate you participating.
All right.
Yeah, thanks for participating in this call tonight. Again, if you have a question for your representatives, *3 on your phone right now. And continuing on the education theme, we're going to go to Francis, who's got a question about education funding. Go ahead, Francis. You're live with your representatives.
Hello. At the beginning of the session, you mentioned that we are failing to meet to fully fund our educational system according to some mandate. And my question is, what does it mean, fully fund? By what standard? Who is it who sets that? And what is the mandate there?
This is Representative Springer. 3 or 4 years ago, the legislature passed a set of bills. They're etched. The numbers of those bills are etched in our memory. That's 2261 and 2776. And those bills defined what a basic education is in the state of Washington. So that was defined in terms of what class sizes should be in K through six. It also defined how many librarians you should have for a school. We use this term, the prototypical school. So we set up a school of 600 students and said, this is how many teachers you should have to keep class sizes at the appropriate level, how many librarians, how many principals, how many janitors, how many, you know, all of that to determine what the staffing ratios should be. Then we also passed some legislation that indicated what kind of credits and what kind of subject matter proficiencies our students should have before they graduate. The Supreme Court then looked at that and said, we agree. That now constitutes the state's definition of basic education. And we know roughly about how much that will cost. And the Supreme Court, in their mandate in the McCleary case, said, we're not arguing with your basic education definition. We are simply telling you, you must now fund it fully. And that number, from the time we began till the time we fully fund it, if you add it all up together, is probably about a little over $5 billion more than we were currently putting into K-12. So that's the number we're shooting for. We have several years to get there, but we're getting close.
So remember, this is Representative Goodman, that's $5 billion more sustained, not just sort of an extra little infusion of $5 billion, but we would have to raise that level and keep it there. And so I've sort of done the calculation. The court has required that we get this done by the 2018 school year. So we, so far, have put in about one-sixth of the money necessary to meet the mandate, and we're halfway there. So we are really behind the eight ball, and we're going to need to come up with significant funding for our public schools soon.
All right. Thank you, Francis. A great question. Again, if you got a question tonight, star 3 in your telephone. Got a lot of great questions coming into the queue here. Next, we're going to go out to Angie, continuing on the education theme on pre-K. Angie, go ahead. You're live with your representatives.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am just curious about the preschool voting that was passed in the city of Seattle, the proposition so all preschoolers could go to school within the city. My questions are, I know that applies to Seattle, but is that close, morphing out to other areas like in King County or other areas in the state? And how will that be paid for, and what would the curriculum be for that?
So I can address, thanks, Angie, a great question. Early learning or preschool is an area I've been working on for years. It's really the best investment. We get more bang for the buck, so to speak, on making sure the kids are ready for kindergarten than any other public investment. So on the state level, we are continuing to expand preschool because we know how much it works. I got a bill passed in 2010 which guarantees for any parent who wants to send their kids to preschool starting age three and four, that it will, that it's available to them. And that's by the 2019 school year. So we're phasing in basically what is an entitlement for parents to get some public subsidy. So if you earn a lot, you'd only get a little bit of help from the state. It would be on a sliding scale. But we would be able to help parents. And I remember sending my kid to preschool, $850 a month. So that's quite a burden for, you know, middle-income folks, and we want to provide relief. And then preschool is very valuable for kids from many different backgrounds, all in the same class. We have a lot of standards that we're meeting or exceeding. The quality of preschool programs in Washington State is very, very high. So I'm not worried about that. I just want to worry about I want to expand access for parents. And we're getting there, but we are going to have to fund it, and that's probably about $500 or $600 million to get that done by 2019.
All right, thank you for that question. A lot of great questions coming in tonight. Again, star 3 if you want to ask your representatives, Larry Springer and Roger Goodman, a question on tonight's call, and we'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Sally, who's got a question about housing. Go ahead, Sally. You're live on the air with Representative Goodman and Springer.
Oh, hi there. This is Sally in Woodinville. I'm very concerned about housing and also about education. They're both priorities. And I don't know how the state determines where the responsibility begins and the local community's responsibility begins. And I think there's some conflict here in our community about what responsibilities are priority for the city versus state priorities for the state. And the other thing about, I have 5 children and lots of grandchildren. I'm 77. I want a little anecdote, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I took my twin grandsons, who are in third grade, to the market to buy a birthday card for an aunt. And we looked at the various birthday cards, and I picked one up. It happened to be written in cursive, and they looked at me and said, "What language is that?" Cursive is not being taught in our schools, and the children think it's a foreign language.
Sally, I really appreciate that. As a former elementary school teacher, I remember teaching school right out of college, and my students asked me, "Who is Mickey Mouse?" And that scared the heck out of me. But to get to your question on housing, we really need a comprehensive statewide approach to our housing affordability crisis, and that includes both the state and local jurisdictions. So let me just give you a couple of ideas that I've certainly been working on for the last several years. One, I think the state has a responsibility and an obligation to make funding available to local entities to provide affordable housing. We do that through our capital budget. There's an item in there called the Housing Trust Fund. It has been as high as $200 million a biennium and as low as 50. It kind of fluctuates depending on the economy. We're hoping to get it back up over $100 million, $150 million this time. And that sends money out to local housing authorities who in turn then acquire land and buy and build units that are affordable. I also have a bill that I've just introduced that will allow local jurisdictions, cities and counties in King County, to use the revenue they get from the hotel motel tax to bond against that money to build affordable housing. So I'm hoping that bill will pass as well. But the real bottom line, where the rubber really meets the road, is at the local jurisdiction. So much can be done for housing affordability if counties and cities, mostly cities, take an active role at zoning their land in a way that allows the densities necessary to bring the cost of housing down. That's usually pretty controversial because people don't like density, but it's the only way that we can see any way forward to really achieve the housing affordability that we need. So state, in terms of appropriating money for the locals using that through their land use policies.
All right. Again, thank you for that. If you've got a question for your representatives tonight, press star 3 on your telephone. Next, we're going to go out to Gene, who has a question about the criminal justice system. Go ahead, Gene. You're live with your representatives.
Hello. Questions are, when will we get rid of mandatory sentencing? When will we return to providing education and vocational training to prisoners? We have good data that's been in the paper connecting this to reduced recidivism as well as saving a whole lot of money.
Hi, Gene. It's good to hear from you. And I'm glad you asked that question. So we have a structured sentencing system in our state, which means that if you commit a certain crime, the law provides that you get a certain penalty. The judge does not have a lot of discretion. You could call it mandatory sentencing. Actually, the judge does have the discretion to go above or below that prescribed sentence range, but very rarely does. The reason we have that, actually, is so that there's not excessive disparity across the state. One particular judge might not have enough coffee in the morning, or you know, you might be in the wrong county. So we want to have sort of equivalent sentencing for equivalent criminal behavior. As far as education in the prisons, we've been struggling, and I really hope we can get it done this year. There's a bill coming through my committee soon to authorize higher education in the prisons. This was prohibited in 1995 in sort of a wave of reaction against crime, but boy, was that counterproductive. When you're a prisoner and you start taking classes, you lose the identity as a prisoner and you become a student. And you never want to go back to prison again. And so those prisoners who receive a higher education, and many of them are talented and are ready for that, either a two-year or a four-year degree, their recidivism rate is 4%. So they basically never go back. So we really need to spread a higher ed into the prisons, just for public safety purposes.
Gene, this is Larry. I just want to follow up on a personal experience we had this summer. Myself and my legislative assistant, Ariel Taylor, went out to Monroe to visit with some prisoners in Monroe who were advocating for additional educational opportunities for them in the Monroe penitentiary, and for those very reasons. And these were people advocating for educational systems that taught really high-skill jobs that actually land them, or skills rather, that land them actually good-paying jobs. The irony was when some of those prisoners were in Walla Walla, they actually got the training, but it didn't exist in Monroe, and when they got to Monroe, they lost their ability to finish the degree they were working on in Walla Walla. So we're going to try to fix that, because Roger's absolutely right. You get some training, and you just don't ever go back. So thanks for the question.
All right, thank you. Again, star 3 on your phone, star 3 if you got a question for one of your representatives tonight. Next, we are going to go out to Sharon, who's got a question about marijuana. Sharon's from Woodinville. Go ahead, Sharon. You're on live with your representatives.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for doing these calls. We heard a news report from either Channel 4, 5, or 7 saying that apparently Washington State is bantering around the idea of selling pot out of vending machines. And given the strict rules, which I'm very glad about placing pot-selling stores within proximity of schools, I'm wondering how they think they're going to regulate who buys pot out of a vending machine.
That's a good one. Thanks, Sharon. I seriously doubt that we're going to have marijuana vending machines. I suppose you could put a marijuana vending machine inside of one of these highly regulated stores, but that doesn't make a lot of sense. And I have seen some companies try to sell this in the state, but no, that will not be permitted. it's very high, very strictly regulated now, and I like that. You have to go into an enclosed place, and you have to be of age, and we're really actually reducing access to young people.
Okay, excellent. Greg, thank you for that question. Next, we're going to go out to Linda, who's got a question about education funding. Linda from Redmond, go ahead. You're live with Representatives Goodman and Springer.
First of all, thanks for putting this on. I just picked up my phone, and there it was. I think this is good. Just a quick comment on tent cities before I ask my question. I had the pleasure of having a tent city just about half a mile from my home this winter, and for people who are interested, you actually can go on a tour of your tent city if it's near you, and they will give you a list of things that they need, and you have the opportunity to help those people in need who are really close to you and find out that it's a very organized and very structured program that they have. So just for people who are listening, if they have a tent city nearby, they can use it to their advantage and help people. My question about education has partially been answered with some of your conversations beforehand, but how you talk about funding our schools, what specifically do you feel are the areas of being funded? I personally know many teachers who can't even afford to buy a home, and here they have a college degree, and they're not well paid, and the expectations of our teachers in our education system is getting to be very stressful, and we're losing a lot of competent teachers because they're leaving our education system because of it. Can you elaborate on that, how you think we can handle some of this in our education system?
Linda, this is Representative Springer. You've hit on a really critical part of our obligation under the McCleary mandate to fully fund our K-12 system and to fully fund those two pieces of legislation that defined what a basic education is. The Supreme Court has said that part of our obligation under the McCleary finding, in addition to funding the services and the class sizes and all of that, is that we must also fund compensation levels for our teachers that are high enough to attract good quality teachers. The Supreme Court did not miss the fact that the single most important element in a kid's education after mom and dad is the quality of the teacher in the classroom. I used to teach elementary school, and I can tell you unequivocally that a good teacher with 35 kids in his or her class will turn out better outcomes than a poor teacher with 15 kids in his or her class. So the quality of the teacher is critical, and the only way you get quality teachers is to pay them, and we have that obligation under McCleary now to do that. One of the struggles we have is that most local districts are paying their teachers out of their own local levies to bring them up to the standard of living necessary to just live nearby. So, for example, the state has a statewide salary schedule. We pay all teachers the same based on their skill levels and their experience. But if you live in Bellevue, it costs a lot more to live in Bellevue or Kirkland than it does to live in Ritzville. Yet the state pays the teacher the same in both places. So we're looking at ways to try and adjust our salary schedule for the regional cost of living differences. It's a controversial idea, as you might imagine, but we're going to try this year.
This is Representative Goodman. You're right. Teachers are not paid enough. We've only given them a cost of living adjustment once in the last decade, basically. We will give them a cost of living adjustment this year, but it's still not going to be enough to compete with the same type of teaching jobs in other states. Teachers don't last very long in our public schools. They get burned out and they're underpaid. But the mandate from the Supreme Court and our obligation under the Constitution is really, the different categories I can think of are completing the phase in of full-day kindergarten throughout the state. Full-day kindergarten is still not available in every school. Reducing class sizes in kindergarten through third grade, where the evidence is very compelling, it improves student performance. What we call MSOC, maintenance, supplies, operations, sort of the boring stuff, but you need to run schools with papers and pencils and all the other materials, and that's expensive. Transportation, the cost of fuel and buses, you got to think about that too. And then teacher compensation. So there's a lot of different categories of funding that we're going to have to address.
All right. Again, if you've got a question for your representatives tonight, star 3 on your telephone. That's star 3, and we'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Dorothy, who's got a question about the carbon proposal in the legislature this year. Go ahead, Dorothy. You're live with your representatives.
Hi. I was wondering what your stance is on a proposal for a carbon tax similar to what has been so successful and seemingly with little economic hardship in British Columbia.
Dorothy, this is Representative Springer. Thanks for the question, because that is going to be a really rich topic during this upcoming legislative session. As you know, the governor has made a proposal to institute a cap and trade system to price carbon. And interestingly, just before session started, I spent 3 days in London with the British Parliament, meeting with their representatives to learn about the British experience over the last 10 years with their cap and trade system. And there were a lot of lessons learned there, pitfalls to avoid. Some of those pitfalls that London, that the British and the European Union were able to avoid over the last few years are ones we're going to have to address here, because we're set up for some of those pitfalls. I like to define this problem in two ways. One, you first of all have to have the political leadership and the political agreement to actually price carbon. You have to be able to say carbon emissions will now have a price. You must pay for them. Once you get agreement to do that, and we do not have agreement to do that yet, but once you do, then you sit down and figure out how do you price it. You can just add a tax based on the amount of emissions you put out. The British will tell you that doesn't work very well. Or you could have what's called a cap and trade system. It's very complicated. We probably can't describe it here in this town hall. That's what the British use. That's what the governor is proposing. The system in British Columbia works relatively well up there, although they've got a slightly different form of government there, and they're also more tied to the British system. So the only way it will work here is if we are able to gain a market for cap and trade that includes California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and arguably maybe even Idaho and Montana. It does not work really well to do it in a single state because you're just not big enough. So it's out there. We're working on it. I think we got to do it eventually.
This is Representative Goodman. I now sit on the Environment Committee. I was actually trained as an environmental lawyer. It's my original expertise. And we've heard testimony for 2 days now on the governor's carbon pricing scheme. There's a lot of resistance from, no surprise, from the energy-intensive industries. About 130 firms have been identified as sort of the biggest polluters in the state. They would be, under the proposal, required to purchase a credit, basically, for each ton of carbon produced. That would be one credit, and it would be purchased at an auction. And this is working in many other jurisdictions, but as Larry said, we can't have it stop at the border. For instance, we're wheeling a lot of coal-fired power in from Montana, and so the question is, how would that count? So like coal-fired power produces about a ton of carbon for every kilowatt hour, but natural gas and other cleaner forms produce maybe half the amount of carbon. So the amount that each company would pay would be according to that. But we're at the very beginning. This is a new proposal, and there's a lot of adjustments. So I don't know how far it's going to get. I'm a co-sponsor of the bill, and I'm supporting it very strongly. But a lot of education necessary and a lot of politics around it.
All right, great question. Thank you for that. We still have a few more moments for questions for tonight's call. So if you have a question, star 3 will get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Diane, who's got a question about the road usage charge. Go ahead, Diane, with your question. You are on live with Representatives Goodman and Springer.
Hi. I like these town halls. They're awesome. I'm a disabled woman due to 3 car accidents. And I need to use my car to get anywhere I go because I can't do a lot of walking or riding the bus or biking at all. And I live on a fixed income. And what I'm worried about is how high the car tabs are going. being that I pay rent and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden I'm hearing about how we're going to start getting taxed for each mile we drive. And I'm wondering how that's going to work and keep people that are on fixed incomes not paying a huge amount per year for their car tabs.
Diane, this is Representative Springer. I would be interested to know, and you can contact our offices afterward and just give a call. I'd be interested to know the degree to which your car tab fees have gone up. They've been holding relatively steady the last several years. There have been some areas of the region that voted for some increases in the car tab fee, which were voter approved. So let us know in particular what your experience might have been there. But to get to your question about a charge for miles driven, there is a proposal now to set up a pilot project. Would not be in effect for everybody, just be a pilot project, much like they're doing in Oregon. Because one of the things we're learning is that in order to maintain our roads, we have relied over the years on the gas tax. And that's a flat fee that doesn't go up or down with the price of gas. It stays the same all the time. And, the good news is we are driving more fuel-efficient cars. We're driving more alternative fuel cars, electric cars, hydrogen cars, that sort of thing. And so the revenue that we're getting from the gas tax is going down. Yet our cost for our roadway and our transportation system is going up. So we have to find a new revenue system. And one of the proposals out there is called VMT, Vehicle Miles Traveled. And it would simply charge people based on the number of miles they travel. There's all kinds of ways to organize that. You could put minimum amounts in. You could put maximum amounts based on income. There's any number of ways to soften the blow on people who really have a hard time affording it. So I wouldn't get too worked up about it just yet because we're a ways away from anybody actually proposing and instituting that.
Thanks for the question, Diane. Most people think of it, I guess, a sense of fairness, sort of like a user fee. If you're going to use a road, you pay for what you're using. And a number of European countries, for instance, have a card that you swipe. You before you enter the roadway, you swipe your card, and it charges you, and then you swipe when you leave, I guess, and it charges you for the amount that you drove. I am, however, very concerned about those such as yourself on fixed incomes, those who have limited means, so we'd have to provide some sort of relief for them. And also for those who work and travel a lot in their work on the roadways, doing whatever it happens to be, and so they have no choice but to be driving a lot on the roadway to provide relief for them as well. So we're at the very beginning of considering how we're going to be paying for our roads, but it's one of those considerations.
Right, excellent question. Again, if you have a question, *3 on your phone right now, *3, and we'll get you in the queue. Next, we got Ian, who's got a question about campaign financing and the Citizens United case. Go ahead, Ian. You are live with your representatives.
Hi. HCM 4000 is a memorial that's currently in committee. It's planned to be voted on Monday. Should it pass committee and reach the floor, I'd like to know how the two of you plan on voting on it. It, as the host just mentioned, it exists to basically add Washington to a list of states which includes California, Illinois, and Vermont, that is calling for a constitutional amendment to readjust campaign financing?
Yeah, thanks, Ian. I'm a very strong proponent of whatever we can do to roll back the terrible decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court, not just Citizens United, but going all the way back to 1976, the Buckley versus Valeo case, which held that a campaign contribution constitutes speech and therefore cannot be is protected and can't be limited in many ways. So in my opinion, on the federal level, excessive private money in campaigns is the most important problem that needs to be solved because money tinges every issue dealt with on the federal level. Here in the state, we have campaign contribution limits, and I don't believe we're unduly influenced here as they are on the federal level. But, yeah, let's overturn Citizens United.
I would agree. I would vote for the resolution. The Citizens United action has probably done more to damage our democracy than anything in the last 100 years. So I'm a full supporter of that as well. I think it is good to know, however, to make people feel a little better, as Roger just mentioned, Washington State has arguably some of the most strict campaign disclosure rules in the nation. You can argue whether we have too much money in our system or not, but at least we tell you where it came from in most cases. So we're pretty good at that. So.
All right. Thank you for that question. Next, we're going to go out to David, who's got a question about I-405 tolling. Go ahead, David. You're live with your representatives.
Oh, hi there. This question is somewhat similar to the previous one about tabs. Some time ago, in the middle of the night, they started putting toll roads on I-405 between Bellevue and Linwood. I don't recall the public ever being asked about that. And then I just recently got an email from Good2Go. This is the agency that regulates tolling, asking for input on what the toll should be. And by gosh, they're considering tolls as high as $10 in peak times. I'm concerned that these new tolled lanes on I-405 are going to be express lanes for the rich. It's really what it's going to come down to. I believe it's become undemocratic to have this variable tolling that can go that high. I would rather see it equalized, and I'm a little concerned that they're running amok with their tolling proposals. Can you comment on that?
Sure, David. This is Larry Springer. There's been a lot of debate over the last several years over how to structure the use of the additional lane capacity on 405, and the collective wisdom arrived at the notion that it probably needs to be what we call a hot lane, which means that anyone can get in it. You don't have to be a carpool. You can get in it, but if you're not a carpool, you'll have to pay to get in it. And the discussions going on now are, in fact, around what should the tolls be at what hours of the day, depending on the congestion levels. And you're going to see a range of tolls right now, high of $10 to probably a low of a dollar. That will vary. The Transportation Commission will set those toll levels. The legislature will not. We simply authorize tolls to be instituted, but we don't make the tolls. So the Transportation Commission, as you have mentioned, is taking public testimony. I don't know where they will end up. I do know that when we looked at ways in which methods that we had to pay for the additional capacity on 405, the money that was generated by the gas tax and other transportation funding mechanisms was simply insufficient. And that's why tolling was arrived at as a way of paying that. That's why you're seeing it also on the 520 bridge. You're seeing it all over the nation. It's coming. It's a matter of trying to make it as fair for people as we possibly can. So I appreciate your concerns about that, and we have the same ones, and we'll give that same input to the Transportation Commission. Thank you.
And David, this is Representative Goodman. I got the same email today from Good2Go. I bet we all did. And I guess I wasn't alarmed. I was just sort of resigned. It's an inevitability, I suppose, that they're talking about basically tolling the box. In other words, I-90, 520, 405, and I-5, that box. I thought that we were only going to be tolling east-west and not north-south. But the north-south will be hot lanes, so I guess there's a choice. But you're right. I'm very concerned about sort of the express lane for the rich, as you're saying. There's also a concern I have that the tolling does not reduce congestion. There were studies showing that it really is just for the purpose of raising revenue. But it is happening, and so I guess we're just going to have to get used to what the rest of the country does. We're very unusual out here. We don't have as many toll roads. If you go anywhere else, they're all over the place.
All right. Thank you for that question. Next, we're going to go out to Abe, who's got a question about mental health. Go ahead, Abe. You're live with your representatives.
Yes. Good evening. I was wondering that there's so much private wealth in this area in the state and locally, and in the area of mental health, how can we be down in the 48th? Is the legislature doing anything to try to bring private money into programs, a joint private-public kind of program?
Hi, Abe. I recognize your voice. Very glad to hear from you. You're a champion in addressing the mental health issue, so thanks for the work you're doing in the community. We had a hearing today in the Judiciary Committee about, it wasn't so much private, you're right, there's a lot of wealth in our community and we do need to be raising money, but frankly, as I said in the beginning of this call, Washington State ranks 48th in the country in what we're investing. So, you know, it's up to us, the state, to start investing in the mental health system. But we did hear about an innovative program in Pierce County where the county hires private psychiatrists to do the competency evaluations. There's a huge backlog of those who are mentally ill and are not able to handle a trial where they might have committed some wrongful behavior. And so we're sort of going to the private sector to do that, to handle that backlog. But that's a little bit of a different issue. You're talking about raising money for the system. And, that's the state's responsibility. And a court has told us we have to do it. And so we're going to have to pony up.
Yeah, Abe, this is Larry. And I just parrot Roger's comment about the commitment you've made to this issue over the years. It's to be commended. I think Roger's right. The state has an obligation to make sure that certainly the least among us have access to the kind of mental health services that the wealthiest among us have. We're taking a look at that. This should be a state where it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, your basic needs are taken care of. And we're certainly working toward that. And I think the Supreme Court decision in terms of mental health boarding and the fact that that's no longer constitutional has been a wake-up call. So thanks again, Abe. I appreciate the call and the question.
Yeah, thank you, Abe, and thank you, everybody, who participated in tonight's call. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for questions. If you did not get a chance to ask your question tonight or you didn't want to ask it live on the call, if you stick on the line for just another minute or two, you'll have an opportunity to leave a voicemail for your representatives, and they'll get that a little bit later on tonight. Now I'll go ahead and turn it over to the representatives for some closing remarks.
So this was Larry and I have been doing this for years, and I got to say this is probably the best one we've ever done. Terrific feedback from the citizens in the district, 18 calls on a wide variety of issues. So we're going to do this again. We really want to stay in touch with you. And it's important, we really want to know what are your priorities and what are your values, because we represent you, and we want to make sure that we're doing that competently. And so very much appreciate your listening in and your questions. And don't hesitate to contact us, email, or email is kind of tough. We get thousands of them. So a phone call is nice because then we can actually talk to each other. And when we're back in the district, make an arrangement to get together with us personally. So thanks very much.
And I'll parrot that as well. This is Larry. I also want to remind you that we will have an in-person town hall probably in March sometime, I think, back in district on one of the weekends we come home from Olympia. So we'll make sure we send out an email. If you want to be on our email newsletter list, make sure if you're not already on there, send an email to our offices and let us know, and we'll get you onto that email list, and then you'll get notifications for that. But it'll be March 19th, somewhere in district. We haven't picked a location yet. So, again, my thanks to all of you for taking time during your evening hours to join with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.